Good afternoon. I'm Lisa Godley, filling in for Barbara Hambley. There has been a lot going on in the news of late, among them the mistrial of a South Carolina officer on trial for the shooting death of Walter Scott. Anthony Burfitt's public corruption trial is winding down, and local businessman Bruce Smith joins us to talk about his open letter to the mayor of Virginia Beach, citing discrimination. The Another View Roundtable is in the studio and ready to weigh in on this and so much more right after this news from NPR.
Discussing today's topics from an African-American perspective, this is Another View.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Another View. I'm Lisa Godley, filling in for Barbara Hambley. So much to talk about on today's Another View, and topping our list of topics is developer Ruth Smith's open letter to the mayor of Virginia Beach. Is the city of Virginia Beach discriminating against minority business owners? Developer Bruce Smith thinks so and is calling for a racial disparity study. This is just one of several topics that our roundtable pundits are on hand to discuss. Joining me now in the studio, journalist and talk show host Will LaViste. Hello, Will.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
And Virginia Pilot columnist Roger Chesley. Hi, Roger. How are you?
Hello, Lisa. Happy early Christmas to you. and it's always nice to see you in the big chair, too.
Well, thank you so much. It's such a pleasure.
She's got on a Christmas green going.
Yeah, she does.
And community activist Bill Thomas. Hello, Bill.
Good afternoon.
I'm so glad you could join us.
Hey, up in Washington doing business.
All right.
With the new president-elect.
Glad you flew in this morning.
Absolutely.
Carol couldn't be here today, but also joining us, former NFL great, now developer, Bruce Smith. Bruce, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me, Lisa.
Now, I want to start by saying we did invite Mayor Sessoms to be a part of today's conversation, but he was unavailable. But he has said in the past, or in interviews in the past, that the city of Virginia Beach does not discriminate against minority business owners. Bruce Smith feels differently and recently wrote an open letter to the mayor expressing his concerns. Bruce, what was it that caused you to say, I'm going to sit down and write this letter?
Well, this experience started 10 years ago. I've been meeting with the mayor for at least 5 or 6 years talking about this very subject. And whether it's this is done intentionally or unintentionally, the result is still the same, and it's called a group of people being disenfranchised. It's unfortunate that it has come to this, considering there have been many opportunities to kind of move in the right direction and to put steps and measures in place to solve this problem. However, they've been extremely slow. The plan and the resolution that they put in place in 2008, in which they would reach, the city council passed a resolution in 2008 to increase minority business spending in three different categories, and that goal was to reach 10% within 1 year. Pretty aggressive, but don't set a goal that you fail to realize that it's that aggressive and you have no intentions of actually reaching that goal. So having said that, fast forward 8 or 9 years. In 2016, in architecture and engineering, it's less than 1%. In construction contracts, it's 2.7%. In goods and services, if I'm not mistaken, that number is a bit higher, but I can't get that. I think it's around 8 or 9%. But keep in mind, goods and services is the easiest that you can raise the bar on in a short period of time, because we're talking about cleaning services, janitorial jobs, lawn services, and things of that nature. That's not economic empowerment. That's living from paycheck to paycheck. And there's a problem with that. Couple that with my 10-year experience of bringing proposals to the table to the tune of roughly, with all three of those proposals, roughly around $450 million. Thousands of jobs, tens of millions of dollars of tax revenue back to the city, helping to create additional parking structures and things of that nature. It when you couple all that together, it made me realize that we've got a major problem. This major problem, there's this culture of doing business that has excluded rather than included. And it's a structure that's been set up by the establishment. The status quo, greed, a sense of entitlement, and so forth. So it just gave me the resolve and the inspiration that I had to stand up for and use my voice for those that don't necessarily have that platform and that voice to be heard.
Okay. Now, this study, you've gotten some pushback from the mayor about
Yes.
the study itself. Why do you think that the study is being set aside and not going forward with it? Some cities have done the study. I know Hampton and Portsmouth have done studies.
The reason that we've been given is obviously not satisfactory and valid in many minds and many opinions. The cost. Well, I've put together a group to take that out of the equation, which is unprecedented, I might add. We have come to the table and said we'll pay for half of the study. Now, keep in mind, private citizens don't pay for studies where you have a city that has an annual budget of $1.9 billion a year. So for a private citizen or private group of folks that are taxpayers within that city to step up and say we'll pay for half of it, that must show you how important we think this study really is. And we're not saying that this will slow the process down of the plan you have put in place to help take us forward. What we're saying is, how do you know where to start from if we don't have a baseline and we haven't identified the root of the problem and the causes that has got us to this point? You see, if they would have been working as hard as they're working now over the last 7 years, as they're working right now, they're working triple time right now to say we're doing this, 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 and that. But the last 7 years, virtually nothing. I mean, the needle hasn't moved. Less than 1%. 2.7%, and goods and services obviously is drastically a higher number, but again, we're talking about economic empowerment, and goods and services is not that route.
Okay, let's bring in the roundtable a little bit and talk to them about what's going on. Roger, I saw you scribbling over there.
Well, one of the questions I had for Bruce is, how much of this is an issue of race, as opposed to how much of this is an issue of perhaps cronyism being on the ends? We've seen different questions about this before. The pilot reported, for instance, back in 2015, the whole issue over the Cavalier Hotel and whether Bruce Thompson got favorable treatment in learning about the what incentives might be available as one of the bidders, and the other bidders didn't get that. So, I mean, is this a race issue? Is this a cronyism issue? Something else?
I think it's a combination of both.
Okay.
And that's what I made perfectly clear in the letter. Mm-hmm. I've raised the question, and the question is race or cronyism, and I think it's a combination of both. Having said that, the problem is, this is how business has been done for decades. Mm-hmm. And the establishment doesn't want their way of doing business to be interfered with. This is their cash stream. This is their cash flow. And when you sit down and you understand the dollars and cents, the equal opportunity, the status quo, and all those factors that go into play, you're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars, and over time, it even gets into billions. So we have to understand what's at stake right now.
Mm-hmm.
We have, and this point in history, and understanding where we fit in. Are we going to remain silent?
Mm-hmm.
And just allow this to take place and go on? We realize it's not fair. Mm-hmm. It's not a level playing field. And that's what that's what this movement is about, mm-hmm. to create a level playing field for everyone to have an opportunity to do business. I love this city. I love the Hampton Roads area. I love Virginia Beach. And we have good, decent, fair, and folks that just want to have peace and harmony. That's what I'm all about.
Have you heard from other Black developers saying, hey, you know, thank you, and particularly, you know, individuals, names of individuals who have said, hey, you're speaking of some of the same issues that I've had?
Well, I've heard this more from the other persuasion than I have from African Americans, mainly, and minorities, because this is a minority issue.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just telling my story as an African-American. There are not that many minority or African-American developers that are in Virginia Beach or in the Hampton Roads area. So it's, you know, we're in a minority in itself, even if you break that down. But when you look at the scale of trying to do business that I've been trying to do business for the last 10 years, partnering with Fortune 500 and Fortune 100 companies to bring game changer deals to the oceanfront, that number gets even smaller.
Okay, Will has something he wants to ask.
Bruce, you mentioned you've been working on this for several years, and a lot of times people don't speak up because of the personal impact that, or because of their own personal reasons or personal agendas. What has been the personal impact that you have felt as a result of speaking out, and why did you decide, you know, regardless of what the cost, I'm going to speak out?
You know, that's a great question. You know, having been closed out, shut out, door slammed in your face, or my face, for the last 10 years, I felt that there wasn't very much more to lose. Having said that, you know, carrying this torch is pretty heavy, this burden. But then I think about my mother and my father, who were laborers, their parents before them and generations before them, the burden that they had to carry, the sacrifices that they had to make. And I just felt that we were at a point in time that if I didn't speak out, who would? And I could have easily said, you know what? I can sit back and live my comfortable life. This isn't my problem. Buy a house down in Florida, spend 6 months there, 6 months here, and just continue to enjoy life the way it is. But what would that have done for my fellow man? I would have left them behind and not use this opportunity to speak up and stand up for what's right.
What is your message to those who are being silent, and how they can make a difference and help you to advance and move the needle?
Well, it's the people against Goliath. It's the people against the establishment. It's the people against the status quo. It's the people that are in the room and not paying attention to that elephant that's over there in the corner. You got to start speaking up. You got to, don't whisper about it. You got to get engaged. Write letters to the council people. Send letters to the media, op-eds. Send letters to the editorial. Go to the council meetings. Let your voice be heard. Understand exactly what's going on, and understand that it's not a level playing field, and there hasn't been enough inclusion that has taken place for decades.
Bill?
I agree. There's problems, but this isn't the first instance of it. It's been typical. The Commonwealth of Virginia, even this very day, they're going to give UVA and Inova, large hospital in Northern Virginia, $150 million. And then on the Hampton University Proton Therapy Institute, they will give us nothing. And we've been arguing this point in your paper, in the Daily Press, with full-page editorials. What's happening? Why is this capital starvation division allowed to happen? As Mr. Smith has said, construction is probably one of the last gatekeeping businesses in America for ongoing opportunities. It's right there. Geriatrics is going to come up next. But we've been fighting this battle for 20 years in the papers, on everything, from taking land, from not being fairly, equitably giving us money. The Commonwealth of Virginia has given colleges, not even in the Commonwealth of Virginia, King College, $20 million. And it's told us, we're not going to give you anything. And we fought the battle. I agree with it. And we'd love to fight with you. I think it's a good fight. We've been fighting that fight, though. Very, very good. Very, very hard. But it's a macro and micro thing if you want to look at it. I think folks like Mayor Sessions, who I know, family I know, and Patty Phillips and Taylor Adams and people down there in procurement, they are trying to make some differences. It has to be systematic. One thing that we did do, sir, we have Hampton University now is listed as a small business by the Commonwealth of Virginia. So we're SWAM certified. So what we can do now, another big battle, it was fought and we won it unanimously, but we started trying to put some things in place that would kind of take the thumb off of the scales. Mm. And to deal with that, and again, I don't see it, it's all racial. Everything is racial, and Will and I tend to agree with this, but it's just institutionalized racism. From one standpoint, then how do you deal with it? You fight it. You go to the city council meeting. You raise your voices. You figure out ways of how to get it. But capital and access to starvation on things like, they'd lock a lot of people out on smaller businesses by putting blockades up front. You got to have bonds. You got to have this. You got to have that. You got to have letters of credit that they know smaller, especially African-American businesses, can't get. But to be truthful, I think folks like Patty Phillips and Mayor Sessoms are trying to fight that battle against a huge army of resistance. And it is the establishment. There's no question about it. So what I'm saying, what I think is best to do, the thing that gets me, Bruce, is the fact that even when the city of Hampton did the study, which cost them $300,000 to $400,000, they wouldn't even let Hampton bid on doing the study. So I'm just saying, what is all this about?
But sometimes, I mean, we hear things like establishment and they, and it's a lot of vague. I mean, what is it? Establishment is not some Martian that's somewhere on the. I mean, can we be specific about?
I can be specific.
Who we're talking about?
I'm probably not going to make good friends with it. The governor of Virginia, and our elected officials are going to allow UVA and Inova get $120 million or access to it to build a proton therapy institute in Northern Virginia, and we're going to fight them over it.
So in Virginia Beach, where Bruce is talking mm-hmm. about in development, I mean,
the establishment? The people that are making the donation to the various city council members and to the various delegates and who has a stake in this. That is the establishment. The people that are getting the business. The people are doing things. I mean, you can see it. I mean, you want to get a list of things. On my side, and I can see in the email, we wrote a letter to the editor that was published in both papers. For half a page, we identified everybody. We identified them.
I'm going to let you do this in just a second,
but I want to give our callers an opportunity to call in. Give us a call if you want to chime in on this conversation, 440-2665 or 1-800-940-2240. Go ahead, Roger.
Now, what are some of the people and some of the rationale you've been given for not going forward on some of the things that you feel
that you have good plans and good projects to bring to it toward the city.
Well, that's in the letter as well. Yeah. But
for listeners who might not have
absolutely read the some of the statements that were made when the proposals were brought to the table. I can't support you on this project. Mm-hmm. We don't want a cookie cutter project. We don't want a chain restaurant. Now is not the time.
That's a good one. Yeah, that one you always hear, right?
So,
all deliberate speed.
I mean, after hearing 10 years of that. Yeah. And on another note, when I presented a proposal one time, and I'm talking to the one of the elected officials, they wanted to go and talk to a member of the establishment. And I found that rather strange, considering you're the elected official.
Right.
And I put this proposal together, spent a year or two trying to put it together, build a relationship with some of these companies, and was going to bring private equity, new money, not just the establishment's money, but new money, so you can diversify in two ways, with a minority doing business, and you've got new money coming into town, and that's what you want to see take place. You don't want to put all of your development opportunities into one or two or three people's hands. Sooner or later, that bubble bursts, and the taxpayers get hell with that bill.
Let me ask a real quick question. I mean, have you said, okay, maybe Virginia Beach is shutting me out, but I'm going to take something to Norfolk. I'm going to take something to Chester.
Oh,
those opportunities are presenting themselves, and I'm sitting down and meeting with Norfolk, which is my native town. Mm-hmm. I've had opportunities at my alma mater, Virginia Tech. There is an opportunity that very well may present itself in Newport News. So other cities have recognized what is taking place. Mm-hmm. And they have come out front and said, well, if they don't want you to do business there, we're welcome. Now, we're welcoming you. We'd like for you to come here. And
now, have these opportunities come up just since the letter and news of the letter came out, or have some of these opportunities been existing even prior to that?
Not necessarily. But this has made them a little bit more aggressive.
Okay.
And wanting to open the door and show that this is a inclusive city and a welcoming city for all to do business.
We're going to take one more question from Bill.
Same kind of thing. I think you have to do that. I think the city of Newport News is doing that with Mr. Brooks and his development. And they got the shipyard, Huntington, to sponsor something out there to help certify that. But it's a colossal issue of keeping us where we are. We don't have access to credit for smaller businesses. We don't have the governmental support through the institutions. We pretty much lost all our financial institutions, so we have to go to majority institutions. We don't have, on a micro level, things like a small business technology transfer that you can get government funding from, or we don't have small business technology transfer. But in terms of, I'm an economist. Construction is where you want to be. That's exactly where you want to be these days. The Commerce Department is trying to do some things to make that happen. But there's two things that has to happen. I think Virginia Beach, continue the public side of it, because that's very, very good. Virginia Beach is taking some legislation down to the General Assembly this year to try to get passed to ease in the burden for cities to help minority-owned businesses. I think you have to step out of the box like we did with Dr. Harvey's leadership. We became a small business. And we can do reciprocal agreements in Maryland, North Carolina, Virginia. So if it doesn't work here, we can go someplace else. But we have to be cognizant of what's really going on. It's really a bad issue. But I don't think I know you're not calling the people bad, but in my judgment, the city, I think Will Sessions has a real, real, real genuine interest in trying to make this happen. We've been talking to him for years as to how to make this proactive, how to set up business centers to help small business like Harvard has, like Dartmouth has, like University of Chicago has, to help support people and draw external capital into the marketplace to get you out of these some of these blockheads.
And I'm glad you brought that up. I think Mayor Sessoms is a good man. I truly do. And I think Patty Phillips is trying to do what's right by the people.
Okay.
And Mr. Adams, whom they just hired.
Yes.
I think he's going to do a fine job.
Okay.
So this is not an attack.
Understand.
This is not an attack on them as individuals. This is an attack on the establishment and this culture of doing business that has excluded. And whether it's by unintentional or inintentional, the result is still the same.
We get nothing.
Right.
Okay. All right. Let's take a call. Vernon is joining us from Newport News. No? Okay. All right. Okay, Bruce, I know you have to leave, and I want to thank you so much for coming in.
I appreciate it.
Today. Thank you so much. If you're just joining us, we're with the Another View Roundtable, and we're talking about race and government. So much more with the Another View Roundtable with LaVise Roger Chesley and Bill Thomas. We'll be right back right after this. President-elect Donald Trump's cabinet is now worth a collective $14.5 billion. He defends his billionaire and millionaire choices this way.
By the way, some of the people I put on to negotiate, you've been noticing, are some of the most successful people in the world. And one newspaper criticized me. Why can't they have people of modest means? Because I want people that made a fortune. Because now they're negotiating with you. Okay? It's no different than a great baseball player or a great golfer. I mean, we want the people that are going to bring, and they're so proud to do it. These people have given up fortunes of income in order to make a dollar a year. And they're so proud to do it. And you watch what's going to happen. It's going to happen fast, too. It's going to happen fast.
Will, is this a good or a bad thing for the average American worker?
We'll have to see, but this is just so interesting just to hear Mr. Trump say that and know that he's talking about businessmen, capitalists, as if in a benevolent way, I am giving up my salary to work for the government, and they're not doing this in some way to enrich themselves. On the other hand, it is also more transparent than what happens with a lot of our politicians who go into government mm-hmm. without having a huge portfolio. And then by the time they come out, they got a huge portfolio. So I think in that sense, I think most of Americans would prefer to know, well, I know this guy, this woman has already made their money. They're coming into government. I know where their conflicts of interest are. And that's where the news media is really critical. We really ought to be identifying where their conflicts of interest and really informing the public of this. But from a citizen standpoint, I mean, it's interesting to hear him talking that benevolence type of a way, but I would say that it's better to know that somebody's going in a millionaire and going out a billionaire than to come in, not having a lot of money and then leaving, big paper.
Gotcha. Roger?
Yeah, I have no huge problem with the folks that have all this money. There are a couple of issues that are somewhat disconcerting. One, are they still keeping in touch with people who have a lot less than them? I mean, do they really understand the problems, the struggles, the challenges of folks who are not on their same economic level? But secondly, I think the thing that is most disconcerting to me is that a lot of the nominees so far seem to be sworn enemies of the agencies that they're going to be leading. You have a EPA nominee who has fought the EPA, is questioned some things on climate change. You have a education nominee who has done all she can to push vouchers, push charter schools, which is okay if you're not taking the money from the public schools. I was stunned that Ben Carson, instead of naming him as Surgeon General or maybe Health and Human Services, they're going to put him as in charge of HUD. So I would question some of those types of selections. And also there's a high military background in some of these choices as well. Ed, you're wondering maybe as an individual, are we getting enough civilians in some of these roles? Will it be too militaristic for some of the people who would be heading some of these agencies? So that's what gives me pause. And it seems like in a lot of these selections, we're not thinking of the average American. We're thinking it's a very pro-business slant on a lot of these selections.
Okay, we'd like to hear from you. Give us a call, 440-2665 or 1-800-940-2240. Bill Thomas.
You guys just don't get it. Mr. Donald J. Trump is president-elect. I think he's doing a fine job. Some of the individuals that Roger's referring to are retired. They are civilians. They have a background in military. I think of a young man who, one of the men who was a billionaire who owns Hardee's restaurant chain, he understands the plight of poor folks. I mean, most of these people were poor. They started poor. I don't see the issue. Ben Carson, if he can put together a management team to resculpture somebody's brain or separate Siamese twins, he can put together the team of talented people to help him with HUD. I just don't want to see. It's about management. Management don't do the work. Management provides the leadership. Then you find some people to do the work that are very, very competent. So I'm very, very happy with that. It's very good. I think we just had a discussion on the establishment in terms of how the poor folks aren't getting, not even the poor folks, but some of us who are doing well aren't getting opportunities to do things. I think that door of change, and hopefully it'll stay that way. If it doesn't stay that way, I'll be just as mad as I was before it all happened, to say that it has to change. There has to be, as Mr. Smith just indicated, a balanced, fair, level playing field. When we're involved in things that are fair, like with a football game, you measure the field 100 yards, you have yardsticks, you have first down, we do well. On basketball court, we do well. On a track, because all those things are measurable and there's no human injection of personalities or things that come into it that shuts the door of opportunity out for us. I think Mr. Donald J. Trump, President-elect of the United States of America, is going to try to open that door, give it a crack so we can all get an opportunity.
Does his cabinet reflect a fair and balanced
playing field? In my judgment, it does. Okay. I'm happy with it.
Roger.
I'm going to push back on some of your comments about the labor secretary. He has been dismissive about raising the minimum wage, and he's also been dismissive about overtime rules that would put more people into the middle class.
And so, I agree with him.
And I think that that's counterproductive to people who need good paying jobs to help support themselves and their families, to try to get education and get ahead in this country. And when you have that type of mindset by a person who's going to be the labor secretary, I think that's going to be hurt people.
He's clearly a businessman, and he's clearly spelled out, give you a white paper on why he thinks that there should be some regulation with regard to minimum wages and people starting out. We think we should give people a better opportunity to get educated through public charter schools where you are not taking money away from the public schools. A public charter school in Virginia, you do not take, is public. So I think that there's better issues on education. There's issue on starting businesses and growing from there. I think that's a better emphasis. And his positions on minimum wage, I agree with. I think it should be a little bit higher maybe, but you can't set a livable wage. You give people a livable education so they can get their own job and take care of their own families.
I just think we're going to disagree on that, Bill, because
that's why we have a new president.
We have levels in terms of how many years the minimum wage stays at the same level, and it's such a huge endeavor that you have to do in terms of getting the legislation to push that up, and I just think that's a problem.
Just one more comeback on that. When Mr. Obama was first elected, he had control of both houses and the presidency. And if that was such a big, important issue at that time, it should have been changed. But it wasn't. We're here today. We have a new president that's coming up, and they have new ideas of how to get things working, dependent on the private sector and business to make things work, and I agree with that.
Let's take a call. Doug joins us from Hampton. Doug, thank you for calling Another View.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Go right ahead.
I'm listening to the conversation, and I was just kind of comparing myself over the last, my feelings over the last 8 or 12 years of the presidency, and I really started to refer to myself as an inter-republicrat simply because, you have to take a little bit of yourself and look at all parties and try to understand them. But I think Donald Trump's on the right track with his business plan. And I think that with his business experience, I think that the U.S. is going to start seeing the economy turn around. And I'm no friend of Donald Trump. I'm no personal buddy. I'm looking at what his plan is, and it seems to be that it may work.
Thank you so much, Doug. I'll let our
that's a good call.
Table.
I mean, I think the caller makes a good point, but I also hear in there the impression that government is what has been impacting the economy. And I'm thinking back in 2007, 2008, what impacted the economy was mainly the housing market and how businesses who were in charge of giving loans and were basically helped to sink the market. It wasn't government
right.
that sank the market. So if you and it was business that sank the market because of the way people were basically essentially being greedy in terms of let me take the most profit out of this and to heck with everybody else who ends up being underwater in their mortgages. So I'm just kind of the notion that the free market is the be all and savior of it all. The free market absolutely needs to have regulation and monitoring to it in order for it to function and to be successful for all of us.
Okay, let's take another call. Deborah joins us from Newport News. Deborah, thank you for calling Another View.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to make a comment and see whether your panel would discuss one of the things I think that's scary about Donald Trump's appointments to the cabinet being all millionaires and billionaires is that it speaks to this issue of wealth inequality, not income inequality. It's disingenuous to say that these people are going to do without their salary. Their salary is not the source of their wealth. It's their investment. And in terms of communities, people of color in particular, not being able to have access to the same investment opportunities, it kind of ties back to your story with the developer who's talking about the lack of business loan support and so on. It seems like, the rich get richer. The people who have the money are intent on structuring the tax code so that they keep it. And that, that is in a whole nother wave higher than the issue about minimum wage and so on. And I'll take my your comments offline. I'm just interested to hear what your panelists would say to that.
Okay.
I think that she's exactly right. That's what I was alluding to in the very beginning, in that a lot of times as you see who is coming forth as candidates for these public service positions, a lot of the money that is needed to run a campaign, you end up getting a person from a certain class only. And what has happened is you have a government that's full with a lot of people who just represent one particular social class. Obviously, all of the other interests are not going to be served. But I do feel better about knowing that they're coming in with their wealth rather than going in and not having a large amount of wealth and then leaving. Some of the corruption, some of the things that we've seen, which we may get to later in this show, is an example of it.
We're about to
going into government with the purpose in mind to get wealthy off of the public's money is troublesome.
Okay, we're going to take one more call, then we're going to switch topics. Kent joins us from Virginia Beach. Kent, thank you for calling Another View.
Yes, hello, Another View. Yeah, my comment is on the somewhat people think about the overwhelming military folks that he's looking at. And I'd like to roll that into your comments. None of them are wealthy. Say married wealthy. None of them made more than $100,000 a year, and none of them are going to make as much as a congressman, an elected official, while they're in their position. And so they're not there to get wealthy on the government like the Clinton family. So I think he's hiring the right people. They're smart. They're highly revered in their careers. And I think they're going to go forward with and the people that are worried about starting a war. Let me tell you what, those guys are the least those two Marine generals especially are the least leaning towards putting somebody into a combat situation, especially General Kelly, who lost a son. So I think that the wealthy side of it, there is no wealth on those military guys. That's all.
Okay, thank you so much for sharing, Ken.
I agree with the call on that, for sure. That's one of the things that I've been thinking about a lot, too, because, again, if we go back into our background and how the war on terror erupted and all of that, and you look at the orchestrators of that war and what their connection to the military wasn't, that tells you a lot. And we've definitely, as a society, have had too many people who have not been personally invested in any of the wars that have gone on, and too few families that have suffered, you know, the most.
Okay. All righty. We're going to switch topics if it's okay with you guys now.
If we said no, would you stop?
No, I don't think so. Norfolk City Treasurer Anthony Burfitt was indicted last January for perjury and political corruption. He is facing 8 felony charges and 100 years in prison. The jury is now deliberating this case. They've heard from 90 witnesses, thousands of documents. Roger, where are we?
Well, we could know in a few hours. You know, they began deliberations today at 11 o'clock. It was a slightly longer trial. The length of the trial was slightly longer than I think was suggested at the start of this. But now they get to speak, and now we'll see, you know, which version of events they believe. It's always difficult to see what a jury will do. But I don't think that it did not paint a good picture of Mr. Burfitt from the stand, even though I know his attorney, Andrew Sachs, has said that some of the government's main witnesses were felons themselves. Those are often the people that do testify when somebody's in trouble, because they've had dealings with an individual. And, you know, I think it's we'll see soon enough what the verdict is. But I think Mr. Burfitt, even if he is found not guilty, his political future, I think, is over in this city. He'd be hard pressed to come back from this.
Okay. Do you guys think it's regardless of the verdict, it's over for him?
Yeah, it's pretty tough. I mean, I'm not one to kick a guy when he's down. And as Roger said, you know, we need to see what pans out. But even if, you know, if he's convicted or not, I mean, what I feel for is his family. I feel for his wife, his children who have had to endure this. If he's not convicted, he's probably looking at a divorce for somebody who's been through a divorce as a kid and as an adult. Not a happy thing to have to experience. You know, his children have to deal with that. His wife had to hear about all of his, you know, escapades and rendezvous and all of that. You know, it's tough. And, I feel for him, for his family, and that he's going to have to deal with that. And I just hope that for all of them, that they are able to effectively deal with that, because it's not a pleasant experience.
Okay. I just thought it was tragic all the way around, especially at the very beginning when some of his own very own colleagues were speaking against him and wouldn't let the case make his case and judge this guy fairly. So at the very beginning, I just kind of turned myself off when I saw people just saying he's this and that and the other. He had been convicted of nothing. They were taking out petitions to get him out of office, which is citizens' right to do. But all the slander and stuff going on behind it just kind of made it. I just prayed for his family to make sure that he would be okay and hopefully get a fair trial. And he can go and live his life. And those things that Will had mentioned, I hope he can mediate those things through praying for God, praying for his family. Hope things work out.
You know, you got the, or at least I got the sense when he first came on to council that he really wanted to do some things for the city. And he did try to help and have some oversight in the Broad Creek area. And I thought that that was something that, that could help people, you know, increase their housing value if they hadn't had a chance necessarily to get this style of housing before and they did actually have the financing. So I think that he was a voice for some of those folks. However, you wonder if at least after hearing some of the testimony, you wonder if that goal changed. And I think that's something we're going to have to wonder about after the trial is over, after we do get the verdict.
Okay. Yeah, speaking of testimony, it's interesting how, you know, your friends and colleagues start scattering.
Oh, yeah.
When things go down. I mean, I was reading in the Pilot a couple of months ago. They were saying that Mayor Alexander is supposed to be a friend. And mm-hmm. there's a comment in there. I'm paraphrasing. I don't have it exactly. But it seemed like, you know, it depends on what you say a friend is, you know, was his mm-hmm. response. And then one of the most damaging testimonies was, you know, yeah. gentleman, what is his name? As his
the best friend,
as supposed to be his, you know, his right. best
oh,
friend.
Right.
Oh, yeah. I mean, so you see that a lot in this community. I know I've experienced it personally, that people who claim to be in your corner and for you and so forth, as soon as something gets a little tight, you know, they get the scattering, they get the running.
Well,
it's ironic that right here you see some of that with what Bruce Smith was talking about. I mean, where is the support when you have to go out on a limb?
Here's what I don't get.
Keith McNair is his best friend.
They need all that support you possibly can get. But haven't you heard this story before about the state and the banks not being fair, or being right, or being discriminatory? And haven't you heard that before? I mean, it always happens, and you don't see support. You know, I didn't see a lot of people. I didn't see y'all standing with me and telling VDOT to go to the devil and don't take our land.
You're talking about during the emancipation?
Yeah, and that's not over yet. That's not over yet. But the point is, let me get back to Mayor Kenneth Alexander. He's a good man, and he was in a political situation. He had to do what he had to do, and I don't think he did it out of anything, out of bad heart. He was making some moves to come to be a leader. People were making rumors and innuendos. He had to stop that, which he did. So that's just the thing he had to do. Ken's a good man.
And I don't think that friends should necessarily follow other people blindly either.
Yeah.
An indictment, of course, is only one side of the story. But there were some damning allegations in that indictment that came out, before the trial. And, I do think people sometimes say, okay, how far am I going to go with this individual? Is he really my friend? And, those things usually get decided before the stuff hits the fan.
Absolutely.
So if you're a friend, you're going to stay there all the way.
If you're
fair weather, you ain't going to be there when something like this happens. So
this is true. We only got about a few more minutes left. I did want to touch on another trial, the mistrial in South Carolina. A judge declared a mistrial in Officer Michael Slager's, where he was charged with shooting Walter Scott. Slager's maintained all the time that he feared for his life. That's why he shot him. Dorsey Montgomery is a juror who's been speaking out all day. I think we do have time for some quick sound from him.
Well, at first, we looked at the evidence that has been presented. And looking at the video, of course, the video is something that's very shocking. So not knowing everything that we know now, of course, we can speculate. But after seeing the video and seeing the evidence, we understand just a little bit different now.
You personally, when you prepared and started deliberating, were you prepared to convict Officer Slager?
At that point in time, yes. At that point
of
in time,
charge?
Yes. Initially, it was going to be murder. But after we looked at the evidence and read the laws and looked at the things that were presented to us by the judge, we had to come to find out that he didn't do anything malicious. He had manslaughter when he had a brief disturbance in reason for that moment. So based on the law, that would be classified under manslaughter, voluntary manslaughter.
that was Matt Lauer doing that interview this morning with Tamron Hall talking to the juror. What are your thoughts?
I mean,
we got
about two minutes. I think he's about right. I mean, murder is something you plan out and it's premeditated beforehand. You know, manslaughter is usually something like in a situation like that, spur of the moment, you know, misreaction, overreaction. And I think that's about right. The juror who was insistent on not convicting at all is a problem, because you have some jurors that go in and they're just not going to convict a police officer under any circumstances.
But they could have taken a lesser offense, manslaughter, in this trial?
Yes.
I'm not, okay.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Then this guy is crazy. There's no way in the world that a police officer didn't do something that he didn't need to do. And I don't see it as murder because the law won't allow for that. Mm-hmm. But if the lesser offense could have been included, there's no question behind, in my mind, he could have gotten his car and tried to run him over. But to shoot him in the back 8 or 9 times, however many he was, is totally uncalled for.
I think he said he tried to take his taser.
Doesn't matter. The guy was fleeing. He could have done a lot of things other than shoot the man in the back. I mean, there's just no question about that in my judgment.
I just say that there's a column that Courtland Malloy wrote on December 6th with the Washington Post, and I think it speaks to a lot of the frustration that you can be white and survive these incidents, and you can be black and not have a weapon, and you end up dead. And here's where we had video of the officer shooting a man in the back, and that officer was not convicted. And he gives just several, Courtland just gives several examples of this.
Yeah.
And it speaks to, when do we get justice? When do people who look like us get justice? And it didn't come in this case? Really? And we had a video, and I think that's a frustrating thing.
And the major example was the gentleman who just went to the pizza shop
in Washington, D.C.
And went in there with guns blazing.
Right.
But managed to be brought out and survive that.
Right.
And help was on the way when the police are. He had called in. Help was on the way. The man was fleeing. There's no probability that they could have run him down.
Yes,
in the South Carolina case. Yeah. Help was on the way. The man was fleeing. He could have done, in my judgment, a whole bunch of other things other than, and then tried to cover it up and do things to hide it.
Right.
Nah, he needs to be in jail.
Thank you, guys. I really appreciate today.
Thank you, Lisa.
Thank you, Lisa.
All of your thoughts.
Oh, sweet,
and we'll be right back.
You're
right
calming.
After this.
I'm Claude McKnight of Group Take 6, and you're listening to Another View, Fridays at noon at WHRV 89.5 FM.
Next week, it's the chance to support what you love by becoming a member of WHRO Public Media. It's because of your support that we are able to bring you Another View. So plan to make your gift of support during our show next Friday. Barbara will be back and we'll tell you the best ways also to stay on track with diet and exercise during those very tempting holiday meals and celebrations. Our theme music was written and performed by Jay Sennett. Morgan Chase and Hannah Martin are our show producers. Thank you both. Victor Bowen is our audio engineer and Nicholas Thomas answered our phones. We will see you next week on Another View.